Stacey Gross, and this is Two Moms Day Drinking. On Twitter, Michelle has been on the periphery of my awareness for quite a while as a follower of an audio creator that she and I have in common. I've read her posts for months and been curious to know more about her, but the one that really drew me in is from August 24th of this year, and it read, "I'm not a divorced single mother. I am a woman. I am single. I am a parent. I am educated. I am a provider. I am a homeowner. I have all of these things and more. I am resilient. I am determined. I am capable. I am also sexy, sassy, and strong." And after talking with Michelle today, I can tell you that all of those things are true. I knew immediately that Michelle would have something that someone, probably a lot of people, needed to hear about parenting. I could never have imagined all the things Michelle had to say, nor how perfectly she would be able to sum up the things that I spent years trying to explain to family, friends, clinicians, and providers. Over the course of 2 hours, Michelle and I discussed the grief that follows the loss of a relationship of any kind, and how it is a disenfranchised sort of grief that often goes unrecognized, even by the person grieving the loss in the first place. We talked about the importance of speaking openly about our struggles so that others can feel more comfortable to do so themselves. And we also found that we are in complete agreement of the fact that the best thing we can do with those who would prefer we stay silent about our struggles because of how our perception of things might reflect on them is to keep those people at a respectful distance and continue to rise up and sail on. The first half of our interview is today on Two Moms Day Drinking.
There's no way. It's not possible for everyone to get an A+ in everything. And I just wasn't an A+ student, especially with all that tension. There was no way to do that. And my mother, I think my mother was just really frightened of him. So she would tell me, you know, don't trigger him. I'm like, I'm not triggering him. I screamed when I saw a cockroach. Maybe it was the airwake. I can't remember. He threw a chair at my head. And then he chased me around the house with a, you know, those sliding doors that you have, and you put this bar at the bottom so that people from the outside can't slide the door open. He chased me around the house, hitting me with that because I screamed when I saw an earwig. And he's like, "Why are you screaming? You're disturbing me." I reflex. And he whipped me. I for 3 months. And this was in the middle of summer. I didn't wear shorts because I had all these welts on my legs. And I would just, I would just cover them up. And I grew up like that. I was the oldest, and there was a middle sister and a younger brother, and Chinese family. So I was a failure by the fact that I was female. He let out his disappointment on me. Physically, just through physical harm. I had migraines. I had migraines until I ran away from home when I was 19, so that I could choose my own university program and stay in school, because they were not going to pay for a program of my choice. They wanted to choose my program. And my father said to me, while you're living under my house, if you're not in school, you're paying rent. And if you are in school, you're not studying anything that I don't approve of. And I was like, well, this isn't going to work. So I just ran away from home, found work, found an apartment, and went through school, which is the most stressful thing to do as a 19-year-old. Yeah. I don't even know. I have no references. I had a job, but it was an hourly job. I got 35, 40 hours a week, so I was blessed that way, but it was an hourly job. It's not a permanent. Right. So I had no references for an apartment. Didn't know, like, how do you open up a bank account?
Yeah.
At 19, I'm like, I don't know. Just walk in. How do you get a phone line? How do you pay electricity? Who do I call if something happens with the plumbing? Like, no one teaches you any of that, especially my parents. My parents never taught me any of that. And so it was just terrifying. Running away, knowing that there was no going back.
Yeah.
My parents would not, they would have taken me back, but it would have been conditional and it would have been worse than before I had left. Exactly. So I knew that once I stepped out that door, there was no turning back. So I did that at 19. Surprisingly, and I didn't realize this until in hindsight, my migraine stopped when I ran away.
Yeah.
And it didn't occur to me that migraines are not normal for children.
Yeah.
And I would go to bed with migraines, like crying migraines, tossing and turning in my bed until 2 a.m. just thinking, I need to sleep, because that's the only way the migraines can stop. But the migraines are hurting so bad that I cannot sleep.
Right.
And like from, 13 until 19, migraines. And I just thought that was
normal.
I just thought that was my normal.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it wasn't normal for people, but I just thought that was just my normal. Like some people have, you know, asthma, some people mm-hmm. have diabetes, some people have, I just thought my normal was migraines. Mm-hmm. And then I moved out and they went away. And then I have two siblings, as I mentioned to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took it out on them when I left. And I remember getting a call. This is just after I graduated university. Mm-hmm. I had a job. I got a call from my sister crying. And she's like, Dad hit brother, do something. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? I'm 22.
Yeah.
He was, how old was he? It's about 10. 10. Wow. I was 22. My sister would have been 18. I'm like, he's 10. What do you want me to do? And she's like, do something. So I spoke to him. And I don't do anything without their consent. And so I spoke to him and I said, if I do something, there's no going back from this, because I don't do anything half-ass. If you want me to protect you, I will protect you, but there's no going back from this. And you're 10 years old, but I want you to understand, this is what we're going to do. My sister was 18, so it's legally mm-hmm. of age, so she could come and go.
Right.
And I said, this is what we're going to do. Sister's going to pack you a bag, 4 days of clothes. You're going to pack all your school things. You're going to pack all your PE things. You're going to pack all your school ID. And Dad's going to be home in half an hour. I can't get there in time. Go to the bus stop now with your bags. You're coming to my place and we're filing a police report. And then I explained to him, when we do that, you will stay with me and I will take you to school. Don't worry about it. But that's why you're packing your school things, because once you leave and we get the police involved, we need to make sure you can still go to school. Are you okay with that? And he's like, yes. And he said, come get me. I'm too scared. And I'm like, I can't get there in half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And once Dad knows, he's going to lock me out of the house. I won't be able to get you. So my sister and my brother went to the bus stop. And then I met them at the bus station and drove them home. Filed a police report. And it got really messy. I'm 22. How does a 22-year-old prove not only can you care for this individual, that you care, that there's the need to, and that I'm the right person to do it. So I was gainfully employed. I had a car. I had an apartment. And my sister, because she was 18, was able to come with me. So she drove him to and from school because her university term hadn't started yet, while I still went to work. And that's how we managed for a couple months. And it got to the point where my father was threatening me over the phone, calling me at work, and said, bring my son home. And I'm like, well, the police went to your house. Both of you are not allowed under the same roof. So the conditions were, you go to prison or he goes to foster care. So I think this is the best of both worlds, because you can sort your shit out from home. He's with me. He's not in a foster home. So he will stay with me until you sort your shit out. So they went into counseling. They sorted it out. And my brother went home after about 3 or 4 months. But to this day, their perspective on that is I overstepped.
Really?
They didn't see the need for it. They never thanked me for it. They don't even acknowledge it. My brother does. My brother and my sister do. My parents just, they completely forgot about it. They kind of, I don't know. don't want to face it, or they ignore it. But they are both, my sister and my brother are both in really good places now, because I made sure they understood that what was happening to them is not right, is not their fault. And they have the means to, how do I want to say this? They have the means to find something better for themselves. They have the means to be responsible for themselves. And they need to take that responsibility. And my brother did at the age of 10 by reaching out, which was really, really brave of him. He was freaking out. And I did tell him, I'm really proud of you. You're 10 years old and you're asking me for help. And you are, we are blessed and lucky that at the age of 22, I was financially and gainfully employed with an apartment, with a car. And we went through child services interviews. I had to prove that we weren't just being problematic children that were rebellious and just filing a nonsense complaint because we wanted to run away and have some fun. I had to prove that we will get him to school. He will finish his schoolwork. I will attend his parent-teacher interviews, which was really weird because his grade 6, 7, and 8 teachers were my teachers. He went to my elementary school. So I went to the classroom and the teacher's like, I think I know you. You aren't one of the parents, but I think I know you. And I'm like, well, 12 years ago, because my brother and I are 12 years apart, like 12 years ago, if you think back, I was in this very same classroom. And I'm here because, and I did tell my brother in advance, we're going to tell the teacher. Mm-hmm. They need to know so they can keep an eye on you in school and understand that if you're having a little bit of trouble, that it's going to take some time to catch up, that there's a whole bunch of crap going on at home, and it's okay. And I never have conversations with teachers or principals without my siblings and my children too. I don't talk to the teachers without my children knowing. So yeah, I went to his parent teacher interview and we had a chat and the teacher's like, okay, that's fine. He's doing all right. Don't worry about it. And my brother's like, oh, okay. I'm living with my sister now. And teacher's like, yeah, sure. Whatever. Mm-hmm. That's fine. She's, I remember her from 12 years ago. You're in good hands. So yeah, it was, I have no idea. No 19-year-old should ever be expected or need to take on that responsibility. And it angers me, even to this day, that my mother didn't do anything. Now, I know she was scared, but as an adult who has children, you have the responsibility to yourself, to your partner, and to your children. And if you or your children are in danger, I'm sorry, but your children trumps your partner because they're underage. They have no one else to go to. And my mom's excuse was, but he's your father, he's my partner. I'm like, fuck that. I needed you to keep me safe. You didn't do that. All you ever did was just don't anger him. I don't. I screamed because I saw a cockroach. He wanted chopsticks and he was sitting in front of the TV and I was studying, literally, I was studying this time, legitimately for an exam, I think it was chemistry. And he's like screaming my name from downstairs. And I was like, what? He goes, don't you scream at me. You come down when I call you. And I came all the way downstairs. And he goes, I'm in the living room. I was like, yes. And I thought, well, maybe he wanted to ask me about my grades or whatever. He goes, can you get me a pair of chopsticks? I'm like, Dad, the kitchen is right behind you. I was studying. He's like, fine. He went to the kitchen, got the chopsticks, beat the crap out of me with them. I was like, but I'm studying. And he's like, you don't talk back. But logically speaking, as a human being, I wasn't talking back. I was talking like any other human being would do. It's like, actually, I'm busy right now and the chopsticks are right. Okay, I shouldn't have said the chopsticks are right behind you, but sorry, I've got a mouth on me. But I was trying to make a point. Like, the chopsticks are right behind you. I am legitimately studying for a chemistry exam that's tomorrow. Like, this was in high school. And he beat me with chopsticks. So it's, and I found out I had health problems later. And I'm seeing a hormone therapist. And they're like, your body has been exposed to so much adrenaline. What have you been doing? And I've been terrified for years and years and years of my life that I was perpetually, every day, running on pure adrenaline out of fear. I didn't realize that. And so that kind of got sorted when the migraines went away as well. But that was, yeah, that was, but no 19-year-old, like moms, dads, relatives, teachers, you see a child, step in. Oh my God, step in. Should not, a 10-year-old should not fear for their life asking for help. Mm-hmm. A 19-year-old should not have to single-handedly plan, execute, and protect a younger sibling. Like, it just, I have no help. My whole family has that same attitude where the patriarch just runs, just rules. There's one in each generation. It's just the attitude. But anyone out there, ask for help. Ask an adult. Seriously, there's, I didn't know that growing up, that there were adults that would have helped me. I did not know that. I knew of child services, but that's just like a phone number. And because no one talks about it in school, no one talks about it in commercials. You know, you watch cartoons, they can have commercials like, you know, instead of like a Barbie commercial, just, you know, if you have a friend who you think is in danger, go to an adult for help. Something. I didn't know that any of that was out there. It would have been so much easier for me if I'd known. I wouldn't have to wait until I was 19, get a full-time job, find an apartment on my own, work 40 hours a week, go to school 3 nights a week and on weekends. And I graduated in 4 years. Like, I did it in 4 years. I have no idea how I did. And then I took temporary custody of my brother, and then my sister lived with me for a few months just after graduating, landing a new job, and I took them in. No idea how I fucking did that. It shouldn't have to come to that. Anyone out there, there are people that will help you. There are ways. And I think a lot of the reason why people don't ask for help is you don't know what's out there. Mm-hmm. And you don't know that where you're going to, but there is something safer for you and you will be okay. There is. You just, each person's way to get there may be different. Depends on who's around you, who you reach out to. It could be someone at church, could be a teacher, could be a friend, could be a parent of a friend that you know, could be an next door neighbor. Anybody you trust, just talk to them. They will help you find help. There's just so many options out there that because you're scared and isolated, you're not able to find those avenues and know how to get to those avenues or that they exist. It is out there. My siblings coming to me when I was 19. No, sorry. I ran away when I was 19. They came to me when I was 22. If they couldn't have lived with me as 22 and already being out of the house, I would have phoned around and asked. Just ask for help, please. Just ask for help. Don't wait. And if you're a parent, yeah, your child's trauma, there's no going back from that. You're damaging your child. It's not something you can think, oh, we'll get to it later and they'll be fine. No, don't do that. I don't talk to my parents now. I don't have a relationship with them. And I'm okay with that. That's my choice because to this day, they're still toxic. I think I have phone conversations with them once a year. And I'll send them emails with pictures of my children for birthdays and Christmas. And it'll just be short and sweet, like literally short and sweet. Merry Christmas, love, and then all our names. That's it. There's nothing else in it. I have nothing to share with them. Because sharing my life with them gives me no There's no purpose to it. To me, it's like sharing my life with a stranger. There's no joy from it. I don't benefit from sharing my life with them because then they start judging. And I don't freaking care. I don't care what their opinion is. I do what I do. Just find help, please. Just ask somebody. There are people out there. Don't wait. If you're, and my, now that the all us three siblings are grown, my mother is now being targeted by my dad because he's run out of people. So I remember being literally on the other side of the freaking planet, getting a call at 2:00 in the morning, mom screaming, "Your dad won't stop. Get him to stop." I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. You just woke me up. And my dad is like, "Your mom's just annoying me. Just get her to stop nagging me and I'll leave her alone." And then I hear a scream, a loud tumble, and the phone goes dead. So I phone my sister and she's like, what, an hour away by drive? And I'm like, "Do you know anything that's going on?" She goes, "Oh, mom and dad had a really bad argument. I think someone fell." So I called, you can't call 911 from overseas. It doesn't work.
Fun fact.
So I remember looking up on the website for a police station nearby and just phoning a random cop. I said, "Hi, this is long distance. Please don't hang up. This is an emergency call. I'm calling from overseas. I can't call 911. Just don't hang up on me." And I said, "I received a call from my parents. There's a disturbance. There's a history of domestic violence there. Check your records," because I filed a police report when I took my brother. And part of when you take steps to protect yourself, make sure there's a record. So I intentionally filed a police report. And when my parents move addresses, I call the local precinct. And I say, "The family that's just moved in here, there's a history. This is the previous address. This is the previous precinct." Mm-hmm. Records don't follow when people move unless there's actual criminal activity. Because he was not criminally charged, the record didn't follow him. So every time they move, I make sure the record follows him to a local precinct. So I phone this precinct and I say, "Can you look it up? There isn't a record at this address, but there's a record at this other address, same residence." Mm-hmm. "Send someone there now." And I'm like, just send someone there now. I will talk to you on the way, but send someone there now." He's like, "Okay." And I said, I think he's pushed her down the stairs. And he actually did. So my mom did tell me later. And she's like, "Why did you call the cops? You asked me for help. You screamed. I thought you fell down the stairs. It turns out you did. You didn't go to the hospital. Cops show up and you just say, 'Oh, nothing happened.'"
That must be so frustrating for you.
And it's... And to the police officers, it's third party listening on the phone, hearsay. Mm-hmm. I am a daughter, but I was literally like on the other side of the world. So mm-hmm. he's like, "You're just quoting your version of events as you heard them. There was no recording." And they're like, "Unfortunately for these situations, unless it's a child, the adult has to speak for themselves unless you were present. But even so, even if we could take it as a witness, but unless you want something, nothing's going to happen." So I just told her, "Like, if you want help, you need to do something. I can't do anything. I'm not facing this man. I'm sorry. He takes furniture to your head. I am not entering that house, even if I was nearby, to face this man. I send the police. I don't bother going into the house." They've never, when I ran away, they never had any address of mine. To this day, they know the country I live in. They've never had my address because then I know they can't show up. I've got children. They can't show up. I think they got my phone number through my sister occasionally. That's when they call me in case they're in trouble. And they will email me and I will read it when I'm mentally prepared. But I control my exposure to them now. And it's on my terms. In a way, it's a loss. I don't have a relationship with my parents, but I never had one, so I don't feel the loss. I feel the absence because I see other people. But I know I'm not going to get that. And it will just hurt me more trying to have that with someone who is not capable of having a toxic-free relationship, an abusive-free relationship with their own children. Conversations with them now. I have visited their home as like, you know, decades after. Because when I fly back, I will visit them because they're getting older and it's harder for them to leave the house. So I will visit them. And the first thing out of my mouth is, this is going to be civil. You say or do anything that's inappropriate, I am walking out that door. And they know that, and I've done it. I've met them in restaurants where we sat down to dinner. They gave me a ride. We sat down to dinner. And I ordered. I was starving because I think I flew in for a family wedding. Just landed from the plane, starving. Checked in our bags, and then I hopped in a car with them because I couldn't get a rental yet. Went to a restaurant, and they just started talking. I can't remember. They were criticizing me about something. First thing. Either about my weight or, you know, you're in IT. That's how are you going to excel in that? And just critical stuff. I was like, you know what? I'm not here for this. So this is either going to start getting pleasant or I'm leaving. And they didn't stop. So I dropped $40 on the table, walked out of the restaurant, went, oh shit, I don't know where I am. got out my GPS and couldn't figure out how to get a taxi. Because I didn't have the address of where I was. I just walked back to the hotel and got ready for the wedding. So I've learned ever since, just always have an exit. Always have your own exit. Yeah. So whenever I visit them, I have my own wheels. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have wheels, it's like, you know what? I can't get to you right now. I'll see you in the morning. Mm-hmm. Always have your own exit. Yeah. But yeah, that was... Yeah, just ask for help. Oh my God, just ask for help. That was my childhood. Yeah.
I could have half of that.
Story. I had it.
Sorry.
Everyone. It's funny, people ask me that. Like, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. I don't even know how. Not every journey, not every rescue or recovery is going to be the same. I have no idea how I had what I had to be able to do what I do or did to be able to be financially able to take care of myself at 19. I couldn't get a loan. My parents made too much. And as a student getting a loan, you needed someone to co-sign. My parents made too much. I couldn't explain that. Actually, they make a lot, but they weren't giving me a penny. But you don't have to. I did. I don't know why. Well, I do know why I chose to do it alone. But you don't have to. There are people out there. The fact that I could do this at 19... An adult can do this. An adult who has more life experience, more knowledge about the outside world. If I can do this at 19, an adult can do this. If a 10-year-old brother can ask someone for help, any child can ask someone for help. You just need to know that you can do that and there's help out there. Mm-hmm. So you were asking me, Spirit says rising up, sailing on. Yeah. Rising up to me doesn't mean go it alone. It means finding a way. Asking around. When you start talking, that's the thing, people don't talk. When you start talking and asking around, you will have access to people who know what help is out there. you will have you and you will be put in contact with or in touch with people that can help you and that will help you and that want to help you. You just need to, and rising up isn't about being brave and well, it is, but it's not about being brave and going out there on your own. Rising up is about finding your inner strength to ask for help. It, you don't have to do it on your own. Rising up is about finding help. Rising up is about finding your voice, finding someone, telling someone, hi, this is happening to me at home. If you're in school, that's what your guidance counselors are there for. That's what your teachers are there for. That's what your principals are there for. They don't talk about it in school, but they are trained to help you. They're qualified to help you. They know how to help you. They just don't talk about it in school because they don't know that you are looking for that help. Just ask. Just ask. There are people out there. They just, like I said, they need to put commercials. Unless you know about that help, no one's going to ask for it. And the problem out there is people don't advertise that there is this. They put it on the radio, but it just seems like a 1-800 number on a radio. It doesn't reach them. Commercials on TV in between cartoons. You know, if you have a friend that needs help, find an adult, talk to your teacher. It's just such a non-approved or non-accepted topic that people avoid it. And because people avoid it, people who need help don't know that they're not alone. Because it's when I start talking about it, they're like, oh yeah, I grew up like that, or my friends grew up like that. And it's like, holy cow, there's a large population of people out there in the same circumstances, but they're all quiet because they don't know they can ask for help. Just talk. Rising up is about asking for help. It's not about doing it on your own. I did it, but I mean, I chose to. But rising up isn't about doing it on your own. It's about asking for help. Sailing on is about not letting what happened to you control you, dictate where you go or hold you back. Sailing on is living and choosing your path. So I have children now, and I remember when I was 16, starting to save my pennies so that I could move away. Or, well, you don't really run away at 19 because you're legal of age, but I remember saving my pennies at 16 and then making a promise to myself. I'm not having children unless I know I can do it right. So sailing on is about not letting what happened to you before dictate or control or decide for you or predetermine or what your future path is. And I remember friends telling me, like, how do you decide that? You're too young to decide that. No, sorry. You're too young to decide to have children. You're not too young to make a mature decision how you're going to decide when you are ready and when you are capable and able to have children. And it was really difficult to explain that to other people at the age of 16, especially to other 16-year-olds. But no, I have two little ones now. And they know. They know my upbringing. They know why they don't have a relationship with their maternal grandparents, that they're just not nice people. They love, but they just don't know how to love. So that's what rising up and sailing on is. Rising up is finding the help, finding the strength, just to go finding help. And then sailing on is not letting that hold you back. Live your life. Don't let it be an excuse. My father used to say, oh, I had a stressful childhood. Yeah, so? You chose to have children. Don't take it out on me that you can't handle your shit. Chose to have children. I don't care if I was an accident. Turns out I found out in my 40s that I was an accident. Okay, but that doesn't excuse. You're an adult. Take responsibility. Not only responsibility for your decisions, responsibility of this life that you have just created that you now have to take care of. Mm-hmm.
There are so many
things that I love that you've said that I would love to have you expand on. I think the first one, or the one that stands out most to me, is how did it come about that you were going to have your first child, and what were your feelings going into that? Was it a surprise, or was it?
I had children really late in life. I had children just before I turned, when I was in my mid-30s. And it was just, I looked to my spouse and said, it just felt right. It felt natural because we waited so long. It was just gradual. Mm-hmm. I remember when we got married really young. We got married months after we graduated from university. I met him the first day of university, actually. He was really bad at picking me up. Oh my God, he had the worst pickup line. He thought I was someone else. He called me by someone else's name. He's like, why didn't you phone me back? And I'm like, I don't have your number. I don't know what you're talking about. And you expect me to go out with you after that? You confuse me with someone else and I don't even know who you are. But yeah, he eventually won me over. So we got married really young, and then being a woman, your body gets to a point where it gets too old to have children. So I was like, you know what, if we're going to do this, let's now would be the right time. And we just, when we got married, people would ask us, when are you going to have children? I said, 5 years. And then they would ask me again, when are you going to have children? 5 years. When are you going to have children? Five. Why do you always say 5 years? Because every time you ask me, I'm resetting the counter to 5 years.
It's just like a perpetual 5-year period.
Yes, exactly. So you keep asking, it's going to be 5 years. Mm-hmm. Eventually they stopped. And I was like, you know what? It's been about 15 years, but it's been about like 10 years since the last person asked.
Yeah.
And I was mature enough and self-aware enough about what was going on in my life and what happened, and having taken responsibility for my brother and cousins. I've rescued cousins as well, but we won't get into that because they don't know I'm having this conversation, so I don't want to mention that. But I have rescued girl cousins as well, and knowing that I would fiercely protect them as a person, as an individual, not just a human being, but their own individual person, personality traits, strengths, weaknesses, that I would fiercely protect that above all else, I'd be an okay mom. And that's when I decided that when we were in the right place financially, because we were moving around the world a lot, mm-hmm. and stable enough, and my clock was ticking, mm-hmm. that we could do it.
When you're talking about your parents and you're talking about, you had so much self-awareness as a child, and I felt the same way. My mom was, she had a lot of mental health issues, but she was undiagnosed and she didn't have a lot of self-awareness. And as a child in a position of relatively little power in that relationship, it's so hard mm-hmm. to watch them and to be like, but this is not right. And this is something that you need to be aware of in yourself. I'm trying to think how I want to ask this question. I struggle really hard with resenting as a mother now, as an adult woman with children. I struggle really hard with this conflict of like resentment towards the adults in my life who I felt like should have had more awareness or should have dealt with their issues and didn't. And then at the same time, understanding that.
How I did for a while and how I handle that is they're not my responsibility. I'm responsible for myself, number one. I'm responsible for my children, number two. My parents, or the other adults are in my life, I'm not responsible for them unless I choose to be. They've not, except for my parents, the other aunts and uncles, have not asked me to be responsible for them. I remember saying this once before. I'm not responsible for your, I'm not your psychologist. I'm not responsible to force you to seek help. I'm not responsible for rescuing you. You are an adult. You need to take responsibility for your own actions, and you, that's your own journey. It is not my job to guide you on that journey. You need to, you can't force someone to want to be rescued. You can't force someone to be ready to be rescued. You can't force someone to want to start the journey or even look at being aware of themselves. That's a psychologist's job, and they're the ones that need to make that appointment. You can't make them, you can't, no matter how many times you just want to knock them over the head and like, just get it already. And I trust me, I want my mom to get out. And I want my dad to just realize whatever's going on in your head, there are better ways to handle your stress, your frustration. There's better ways of channeling anger that you're not beating the crap out of a child that's standing in front of you just because you can. It took filing a police report against him before he actually changed his actions. And he changed his actions because the police were saying, your son is not coming home until you see a psychologist and change your behavior. And if you do it again, we will be back and you will go to prison. So it's the fear of losing his son, and it's the fear of going to prison that changed his behavior. But he hasn't changed his attitude.
Internally, he is
he's still the same. And when he sees the psychologist, he's like, just give me pills. Like, no, this is a process you need to go through. It is not like you have a cold or a headache and you take some medication until you get past it. Mm-hmm. It's a process you need to work through. And if he's not willing to work through that process, I can't convince him. My mom thinks she can without realizing that actually she has her own process and journey that she needs to go through on her own. And I've tried. And she would call me in tears and like, your dad's scaring the crap out of me again. I'm like, go find help. She goes, I just need someone to talk to. Mm-hmm. Your daughter's not the right person. I'm sorry, 19-year-old, 20-year-old, 22-year-old, I can barely handle my shit. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm not handling your shit, and I'm not rescuing you. She's like, but I need someone to talk to. Talk to your friends. She's like, I have no friends now. Go find your GP. Go find a psychologist. Go find someone in church. Like I said, when I said rising up, find someone to talk to, not a child. Mm-hmm. So, you can't help them. It's easier for me because I've cut them off. I don't see them at family reunions by choice because it's too toxic. And when I do see them, people know, my friends know, they're like, shit, you've spoken to your dad or you've seen your mom, haven't you? I'm like, why? You're a bitch from hell right now. I'm not seeing you and I'm not talking to you today. Like, you, holy shit, you are a bitch from hell right now and you don't even know it. Like, they just bring out the worst in you. And I was like, you know what? I don't need this. So I limit my contact with them, which makes it really easy for me to not feel like I need to get right in their face and say, do something with your life. And I do, when I do see them, I see them maybe once or twice a year, or I call them once or twice a year. I do have that conversation with them. Like, if you want to sort yourself out, you do need to, I can't do it for you. And they're just sort of like, yeah, okay, I hear you. But it's like in one ear, not the other. You can't help them. It's it's like an addiction. It's just, it's habit. They're stuck. It's like that cartoon where like you have the sudden light of beam just show out of the clouds and you're like, ah! Like that realization is just that needs to click for them on their own. They have to, you can't make
it there themselves.
That click. You can't make them switch on and go, I need help.
Yeah.
Or this isn't right. We need to do something about it. You can't force them. You can't. And I stopped feeling guilty about it and I stopped feeling responsible for it. Because I'm aware enough to know that that's not my job. Why am I so, I don't know. I shock a lot of people. They're like, at 16, how did you figure this out? And I'm like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I went through a divorce, a really messy one about four years ago. And I remember sitting in front of the psychologist. So the ex was exhibiting really self-destructive, toxic behavior, mm-hmm. which was putting, I'm not going to get into details, right. Which was putting me and the children at risk. And he wasn't coming home he wasn't coming home nights for several months in a row. And I was like, okay, that's it. I don't know what you're doing, but what you're doing out there is not safe for you. And it's not safe for us. I don't know how you get to work in the morning, but you seem to be paying the bills, but we're not having you in this house anymore. So I moved out. Mm-hmm. He wasn't going to go to couples counseling. He thought it was, anyway. I didn't know this, but you can go to couples counseling as a person who is in a couple. You don't have to go as a couple. You can get counseled about couple relationships as an individual who is in a relationship. So I called and I said, I want couples. Well, I'm going through a divorce and I want some counseling, but partner's not going to come with me. Is there any point? They're like, yeah, come on in. You can have couples counseling. We can counsel you about what you're going through in a relationship. You don't have to have the spouse there. I was like, oh, okay. So I went in. And the first appointment, they have this big, long 200 questions that you need to fill out just to assess mental stability, mm-hmm. if you're a danger to yourself, what you're going through. So that was my first appointment, filled out that questionnaire. The second appointment was to go through the questionnaire and ask me what I wanted. And I said, I just feel I need to be here because I'm going through a divorce and I'm struggling. And then the third appointment, she was like, you were so self-aware. It's slowing you down to sit in front of me and verbalize it. Mm-hmm. You're mentally processing this so quickly that verbalizing it is actually slowing you down. And she said, you've already psychologically processed this in the hour that you're talking with me. Mm-hmm. And I said, but I'm struggling. She said, you're so aware that you're not at fault. You just need to pick up the pieces. You're doing the right thing. You're not to blame. You don't feel guilty. You are coping in a healthy manner. Lots of chocolate, lots of ice cream. And she was concerned, like, are you doing drugs? Mm-hmm. Are you doing alcohol? Are you exhibiting dangerous behavior or risky behavior? And I'm like, I have a glass of wine once in a while with colleagues at work. And she's like, you know what? Go eat the ice cream, gain the weight. That's a healthy way to deal with it. You can lose it later. And I said, well, it's costing me money. She goes, what, the ice cream? I'm like, my wardrobe. I'm going to have to buy more wardrobe because I'm not growing yet. She goes, all right, fine. If you want to put a limit on your ice cream indulgence so that you don't have to hit your pocketbook and buy, you know, clothes that are two sizes larger. And she's like, the fact that you can find humor in this, mm-hmm. and be so self-aware, you're fine. She said, the reason why you're struggling, you're grieving.
Yes.
You can't rush grief.
Yeah.
And I was like, despite what your spouse did, regardless of whether or not your divorce is justified, what his actions were, and whether, if you were aware that this was going to happen, that you would have married him in the first place, the life that you knew is gone. The individual that you knew is dead.
Mm-hmm.
That loving person is no longer alive. He doesn't look at you with love. He doesn't talk to you with love in his voice.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't stand beside you, stroke you, and hug you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't call you to see if you're okay, to say hello, or to say I love you. Even though physically that human being is there, the person that you love, the person that you married or was committed to, died.
Mm-hmm.
And the life that you knew is mm-hmm. dead. The dreams that you had with this individual is dead. So you have to go through the process of picking up your life as though this person died.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out your finances, finding a home, taking care of your children. I had to do all that as though he had died. But he didn't die. It was me choosing to terminate that relationship because his toxic behavior had rejected the commitment, the marital commitment that he had made to mm-hmm. me. So he broke his commitment to me by exhibiting this toxic behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I chose, which is really hard to do, to end the marriage. So it's grieving. And then what's really hard is the person isn't dead. And when you have children or you're in a community that he's still around in,
mm-hmm.
you see this person and it's like, I need to talk to this person mm-hmm. as a stranger.
Yeah.
But my heart is either full of love, hatred, or both,
mm-hmm.
and it's breaking, and I'm still processing this, and you're standing there like you don't know me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, oh my God. So many women just tell me, like, what he did? Just kick his ass out. Why are you crying?
Yeah.
You're better off without him. I'm like, holy fuck. Unless you've been through this, they're like, oh, if this happened to me, he'd be all on his ass in one day. Why did it take you 3 months, 4 months?
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've been through it, holy fuck, that's the worst thing you can say to someone.
Yes.
It's like, I'm going through some shit and you're judging me for mm-hmm. for what I did and how long I took?
Mm-hmm.
Some are like, you married him, stick by him. You've got children, wait until they're grown. And others are like, holy shit, just kick me out in 24 hours already. And I was like, I'm not talking to you. And I lost so many friends because I was like, you are not helping me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard because I was isolated already because I live in a country where I moved to a new country, so I don't have very many friends here.
Mm-hmm.
So most of people I know are work, because until you make those social connections, which takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And none of my family are here. I'm close to my cousins and my siblings,
mm-hmm.
And none of my family are here. So I felt really isolated, but I chose to isolate myself further from these friends because they were not helping.
Mm-hmm.
But by being vocal, this is what I said about rising up.
Yes.
Speak. So I was vocal about it in the office. Oh, yeah, I'm going through a divorce. Like,
mm-hmm.
why would you share that?
Yes.
I'm like,
100%.
She had a baby. She got pregnant. She got married. His father passed away. I'm doing the opposite. I'm undoing a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember asking work, I'm like, can I get leave? They're like, why? You give leave for a funeral. You give leave for marriage. You give mm-hmm. leave for newborn babies.
Mm-hmm.
This is a funeral of a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do you have a court date? You can take a day off for the court date. I'm like, we're doing this out of court. I'm not, we managed to do it amicably, which saved us a lot. And they're like, well, no. And I'm like, I need a mental health day. Okay. Do you need a psychologist to assess you? I'm like, holy fuck, man. No, yes. I could not get time off. I ended up changing jobs to a manager that was really understanding. And he's like, you know what? You put in the effort. I don't care what hours you do it. Mm-hmm. And if you just one day just can't, that's fine. And I remember texting him and I'm like, woke up. I'm just processing a whole lot of shit right now. I'm not coming in today. And his first question was, are you okay? Not, what meetings do you have? Mm-hmm. When will you be back? Or what can I tell people? His first question was, are you okay? I said, yeah, I just need a day. He goes, do you need something? Do you need someone? Do you need anything? I was like, no, I'm okay. Don't have to come back tomorrow. If you need more than a day, that's fine. I said, no, I'll be fine tomorrow. And then when I came into the office the next day, he just pretended nothing happened.
Yeah.
He just looked at me to make sure that, you know, I was fine. And he was like, just pretended I didn't skip a day of work. He just let it be. And he was amazing. And I switched jobs to be under him intentionally because I needed to be surrounded by people that were not going to respond negatively.
Mm-hmm.
So I changed jobs. I changed jobs 3 times, actually. Just to get myself into a better place.
Michelle is one of maybe 2 or 3 people I've ever met who gets my way of thinking. She's frank, honest, and so self-aware that it's actually painful sometimes. Like me, Michelle spends a lot of time evaluating herself, her beliefs, her motivations, her hang-ups, and her struggles. Unlike me, Michelle does not dwell on any of them. With the same directness she uses to talk about the abuse she experienced in childhood and the complicated nature of her relationship with her closest family members, Michelle also brushes it all aside and reminds me that the most important thing is to find your voice and to talk about your life with unabashed authenticity, to rise up, but also not to get bogged down in the past such that it prevents you from moving forward with integrity and grace into your future. To sail on. I wish every single one of us could absorb a fraction of Michelle's self-awareness, pragmatism, and insight. While I can attest from firsthand experience that these are not easy traits to have, nor are they fun or as impressive as they sound a lot of the time, they are the reason for every moment of growth, healing, and forward momentum I've gained over the years, and I guarantee you, they'll be the reasons for every bit of growth I achieve in the days and weeks and years to come. Find your voice, use your voice, and rise up. Next week, I'll wrap up with Michelle as we discuss sailing on, taking time to rest from the emotionally exhausting task of rising up. Please, please do yourself a favor and come back for more of Michelle on Friday. Until then, I'm Stacey Gross, and this has been 2 Moms Day Drinking. The music for this podcast has been written and produced by my father, Bob Gross, on his goddamn electric ukulele.